Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm Alex Sears and my guest today is director James McDonald, whose latest National Theatre play was Peter Hanke's The Hour We Knew Nothing of Each Other. McDonald has had something of a cutting-edge career, having been associate director of the Royal Court from 1992 to 2006, where he directed such contemporary classics as the first production of Sarah Kane's debut, Blasted, in 1995, as well as subsequent plays by her, including Cleansed and 448 Psychosis, plus other equally challenging works such as Martin Crimp's Fewer Emergencies and Lars Norén's Blood. He has also recently directed David Mamet's Glengarry Glen Ross in London's West End, as well as filming Carol Churchill's A Number. In addition, he has worked in both continental Europe, especially at the Berlin Schaubühne, and in New York. Welcome to Theatre Voice, James McDonald. Could we start by talking about the Peter Hanke play? Why did you decide to direct that?
I'd known about it for a long time, and it's been a huge play in Europe, and obviously it's a brilliant play for the kind of ensemble theatre culture that exists in Europe. And not at all here, but it seemed to me it was something that the National, if anybody, could afford to do. And it turned out to be a shared enthusiasm of mine and Tom Morris's, so we got a workshop together on it and did a small and relatively digestible chunk of it, and then showed it to Nick, who was...
That's Nick Heitner.
Nick Heitner, he was fascinated by it, so that's sort of how it came about.
And what's the fascination? Is it because it's basically a mime piece or a modern classic or what?
Hadn't occurred to me to call it a mime piece, although I went to mime school once upon a time. But what's brilliant about Hanke is he doesn't really step outdoors without wanting to completely reinvent what theatre could be about. And obviously in this piece, and it's not the first time he's done it, but it's the first time he did it on such an enormous scale, he just removes the business of language from the equation. And the interest is to see what's left, I think, for him as a writer.
And also he seems to remove a lot about characterization and a lot about the completion of stories. Isn't that right?
Yes, the moment that you take language out, then you're going to tell stories slightly differently. And what he eventually came up with was, if you like, the beginning or the middle or perhaps sometimes even the end of 400-odd stories. Does that remove characterization? No, you still, to make those stories work on an audience, have to completely be a person in the moment of doing whatever they're doing. It's just unlike a conventional play. It's not going to unpack that story for you in the same way.
And it doesn't offer explanations or anything like that?
No, it comes with a marvellous quotation which he made up. Attached to the front of it from the oracle at Dodona, which, this is very Hanke, is a real oracle that he had actually walked to. It's the oracle that he went to if you couldn't get into Delphi, and it's in Albania, actually. Anyway, he made up this thing of the oracle saying, "Don't betray what you've seen, stay true to the image." And it's really an instruction for the director and the actors, I think, to just trust, as one does ideally in any creative work, that the thing, if you make it right, will have its own, will tell its own story without needing to explain.
Some statistics. The show lasted about 100 minutes. There were 64 pages of stage directions. And I think you had 27 actors playing near about 450 characters. Obviously, this is different to organising a regular production, or is it?
Well, funny enough, the rules are the same. You start at the beginning of the script and you just work your way through. And even more than a text play, you really can only work out what the thing is by doing it, by standing it up and doing it. So that was the process of working on it, was just everybody riffing what on earth this little runic instruction might possibly be. There's a huge liberation to doing that with a good group of actors. Partly, initially, that anybody could be anything. And that was...
Yes, of course, because nobody's been hired on the basis that they are Moses or the man with the sort of cleaning brush.
Absolutely not. And that's something I'd done before on Psychosis, actually, and very much wanted to do again, because it's so empowering and liberating for actors to be just hired to do a piece of material without all the responsibility and anxiety that comes with having to play a well-defined role, and are you up to it, and how are you going to do it compared to someone else.
And also it keeps all 27 on their toes, because nobody can think, well, I've only got a small part, I can fall asleep in this particular rehearsal.
No, and everybody was there nearly all the time, which again is quite rare. And the most beautiful thing of all was 27 actors aged between 22 and 83, I believe, all having equal status in the rehearsal room and equal investment in the process. And that is just, I've never had that in my life.
What's the text like? Can you sort of explain, is it all just stage directions? How explicit are they? I mean, there was a lot of joking about the fact that it was a new translation by Meredith Oakes, but there's no words in it. But clearly there was a text.
Absolutely, yes. It's like the world's longest stage direction. It's very beautifully written. It's arranged in paragraphs. It has a rhythm to it, both on the level of paragraphs, but also becomes a part of sections, and even within the sentences, the way they're written, there's a lot of information that you can use in terms of organising the staging of it, in terms of rhythm. And when I started working on it, there are several translations of it out there, but I was mistrustful of them and decided that if all you've got to go on are these stage directions, you absolutely should get them right. And know precisely what is meant by them. And a bit like one always tried to do at the Royal Court, therefore get a playwright to engage, a British playwright to engage with this European writer's work. And that was how we got Meredith on board. And again, I think it was intriguing and perhaps liberating for her to translate a play which didn't involve dialogue. So that was why the translation thing seemed important. Although in retrospect it was very amusing that by advertising that fact we kind of drew attention to what was unusual about the material.
What are the stage directions like? I mean, are they very explicit or are they more...
Some of them are extreme. He's precise about different things at different moments. He is a writer who's incredibly precise about his use of language, and who, I think, having been someone who as a young man sought to challenge or question almost every aspect of writing and of theatre, as a lot of people in his generation did, but in theatre he was perhaps preeminent in that. The kind of truth that he found as a writer he could come up with was just about detail. It was not about big generalities. So his recent work, particularly his prose work, is just extraordinary on observation of people and of things and of places.
Yes, that's quite interesting. Quite often a novel by Peter Hanke will have the writer sitting in a cafe looking at what people are doing, just in very precise, completely pared back detail.
Yeah, that's right. So there's a lot of detail in the instructions, but there's also a huge amount of freedom to invent.
Mm.
And the process of rehearsal was to identify what seemed to be the clearest way to enact an instruction and then play from that point.
Had you seen a previous production? Because I think the original was in 1992, and then there was a visit to Edinburgh by Luke Bondy's production in 1994. Had you seen either of those?
The Bondy one I'd seen on a kind of rather dodgy video at the Shabian, but I've never actually seen it in the theatre.
Because Michael Billington compared yours with his and said his was more playful, yours was more doom-laden, and especially towards the end, that feeling that an emergency has arisen.
I'm not sure I can remember his well enough to comment. But we tried to be as playful. I think the writing is playful.
So
it varied from night to night with an audience, how much they got behind the spirit of it, but there's a lot of play in there, I think.
Yeah, and for example, you had an actor, at least one positioned in the audience, who suddenly gets up and makes their way over the backs of the seats onto the stage. Did you ever have people trying to stop him?
He had a poor guy. I mean, that's in the script as well.
Oh, okay.
That there are three people who come, who can't help but join in to the event. Which is Hank dreaming about the power of theatre, really.
Exactly.
But we put that particular guy who's sitting about five rows back and had to sit there for an hour and 35 minutes watching the people in front of him and speculating about how they were going to react.
But did they ever react?
Stood on the shoulders. Yes, yeah. People told him to sit down and all kinds of things, yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, I think that's wonderful. I mean, how often does that happen?
Yeah.
That a joke actually works in the theatre like that.
That's right.
The set, I mean, it reminded me of a Di Chirico painting.
Mm-hmm.
It had that kind of dreamy, but also very European quality. Could you say something about how you created the set?
European designer, of course, Hildegard.
That's Hildegard Bechler.
Yes. Well, the thing that we found when we were working on the set was it just resisted any form of naturalism. It just felt clunky and literal and over-illustrative. And in my experience of working on sort of sets for plays, you always try to chuck as many different things as possible into a model box to see what smells right. And the more abstract material is, the less it'll take a kind of level of realism. So what we were trying to do was come up with buildings that created a complex space that gave us a variety of entrances, which is the obvious trick to the play, both in terms of kind of in the horizontal and the vertical, but also to create a kind of essential town square that could be anywhere, because whilst he's riffing on a European town square, and we were obviously slightly more centred on London, there are moments where he wants you to be in the Middle East or in history, so you've got to be able to create a space that moves around both in terms of geography and of time.
Yeah, I thought it was very interesting in design terms, because there were clearly British references, I think. The uniform of the policeman, is that right? But there were also wider references, because the firemen seemed to be from somewhere else, and the garbage disposal people from somewhere else again. And then there were, as you say, biblical figures. There were figures from opera and from art and history, So there's a universality about the whole thing, is that right?
Yeah, I think, I mean, we tried to make it, most of those, most of the kind of uniform people were actually British.
All right.
Although we might have selected slightly more oddball ones than you're used to, but the idea of the piece is that it moves around like that, so we were just...
And that presumably is also Hanke's idea that naturalism is a rather sort of boring way of staging things.
Yeah, and I think he wants to wake an audience up to how you look at things in the world. So he does, in the piece, he does actually about a minute of naturalism, and then he blows it up. So the second scene, if you like, is 25 or however many people coming on stage and doing cut-up action. So if the audience was any doubt that they were going to be watching an extended piece of naturalism, he just takes that comfort blanket away from them very quickly. And then he puts it back with more stuff. You know, then you get a guy with a fishing rod wandering across, and he has his own story to tell, and he tells it very slowly. Then he does allow you to think that the piece is simply observational, but won't ever allow you to do that for any length of time. He'll always chuck in something that shakes up your perception all the time.
Yeah. I remember there was a skateboarder who does a bit of skateboarding and then looks embarrassed because it hasn't quite worked. And of course, he thinks he's being observed. But there isn't anyone on stage, although obviously there's a theatre full of 1,000 people watching it.
Yeah.
So jokes like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And was it sort of like choreographing a piece? Did you find that it was almost a dance piece at some times?
Well, I worked on it in the workshops and in the actual production with a wonderful choreographer called Jonathan Barrows. He's a really extraordinary artist. And early on in the process, we did actually have a couple of dancers involved. And we found, actually, that to go into very dancey territory with it was wrong. And really what one needs to get the piece over is very good actors. The actors broadly, as a sort of rule of thumb, have 15 seconds to tell a story.
Yeah.
So they do need to be very good actors to put that story across clearly and engagingly. But there are a lot of rules with a piece like that, which is primarily about movement, in terms of how you use space creatively so that the piece doesn't become repetitive. And the fun of doing it was to identify what those rules were. And Jonathan was incredibly helpful on that.
Towards the end, as I mentioned before, there does seem to be intimations of disaster. There seems to be an emergency, which is unspecified, but which seems to bring the cast together. Some critics have called that a community. And then when the emergency passes, they become individuals, perhaps atomized, perhaps alienated yet again. Is that something that was in the text or something that you enhanced?
No, I think it's in the text. I mean, it's called The Hour We Knew Nothing of Each Other. And it starts with that simple fact that in public space people don't relate to each other and their stories remain private, as a rule.
But I meant the emergency.
And then at a certain point into the piece, once I think the writer is awake enough and the audience is awake enough to the nature of the material, the writer goes, what if people stayed? What if people did relate to each other? And slowly this collective action develops, and it becomes a kind of dream, if you like, of what if we all could relate to each other.
And yet, but the dream is happening during some... I mean, it's a very amusing piece, we mustn't be too ho-faced about it, but the dream of coming together happens under the cloud of an emergency.
It becomes an emergency. Initially, I don't think it is, but then it becomes one. When everybody is collected, then the ice begins to break. There's the sound of ice breaking under your feet, and then there's the sound of animals in pain, and there's a huge amount of dark stuff that comes out. So from it being a collective and positive event, it becomes slightly scarier. And then there's this very beautiful thing that arrives, which is this boat punted along by these two extraordinary African figures. And yeah, I think Hanke, when he was writing it, he talks about this in his notes on the play. Once he got everybody together collectively, it looked alarmingly like a conventional play that was going to have some kind of resolution. And he tussled with the question of how to resolve it. So the boat comes along, it's very beautiful. Is it a positive image? Is it a negative image? Of course, it's more interesting if it's open. Is the boat death, or is it a boat you should want to get on? And there's this beautiful moment where everybody decides, are we going to get on the boat or not? No, we're not going to get on the boat. And one guy tries to get on it and they trip him up, and that's the end of the dream. And then you get, there's one more collected thing, which is a man comes along to tell them something, and it's the final gag that Hanke can pull in the nature of this piece. I think here comes an old wise man who's waited for many years for something to happen, and he's going to come along and make you a speech. And it's biblical. Hanke very often, he grew up in a Jesuit seminary, so he very often reaches for biblical imagery. And he comes along to make a speech, and then he doesn't. What he does is he rehearses it. He rehearses just using noise, a speech that he might be going to make, and then he dries. So it's the biggest gag that you can pull for an audience which is absolutely starved of speech in this event.
Yeah, it's like something out of Absurdist theatre, isn't it?
Yeah, he can't get to the speech. Mm. Instead of which, a woman comes and gives him a baby, and the baby becomes the event.
Mm. Now, a lot of critics did laugh at the production. Some even questioned rather aggressively why the National would put something like this on. Do you think there's a failure amongst critics or even the British audiences to appreciate what is an example of European modernism?
I think we don't get enough of this kind of work, so we're not well versed in it. So perhaps it's more difficult for us than it should be. I mean, the piece itself, it seems to me, isn't particularly difficult. What I did find very interesting seeing it meet an audience is how difficult silence is for a theatre audience. And so I don't find it remotely difficult because, you know, I go and see a lot of dance work and it's a given in dance, but for a theatre audience, silence is really quite disturbing. And I find that very interesting in terms of our life now, that should be the case.
Well, also because silence is quite rare, presumably, in everyday life. And here you're underlining the fact.
Yeah. But the piece, it seems to me, is a very approachable and witty thing about observation and about all of human life. So the audiences that went with it, which I think in my experience of watching it was most of an audience, most nothings, had a very good time with it.